This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later in the show, a program to help writers get off the ground. But first...
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Computers and robots have become a bit too smart have been the driving force behind 2001 A Space Odyssey, the Terminator franchise, iRobot, the Matrix trilogy, and dozens of other movies. But science fiction writers aren't the only ones concerned about a time when your office copier is smarter than you are. Bill Gates, Stephen Hawking, Stuart Russell, and others have expressed concerns over how artificial intelligence is developed and controlled. Joining us to look at the implications of artificial intelligence are Dean of the Northern Kentucky University College of Informatics, Dr. Kevin Kirby, and solution architect and partner at Definity Partners, Dave Hatter. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dave and Kevin, thanks for being here this afternoon.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. That was a nice surprise. It's one of my favorite movies, and I love the whole connection with the, you know, I'm sorry, Dave, I'm afraid I can't let you do that. It's classic.
You know, I saw that at a drive-in theater outside Detroit when I was 8, and I couldn't sleep for a month.
Wow. Yeah, Hal is incredibly creepy. Even now, that big red eye, always watching.
Yep. Yeah. Dave, sort of define this. I mean, when people think about artificial intelligence, they think of something like Hal, but what exactly is artificial intelligence?
Well, I think it goes well beyond that at this point. You know, I think in the simplest terms, you could just think of it as an intelligent machine. Or intelligent software, something that in theory has some level of consciousness and can make its own decisions without outside input. And, you know, I think this is a lot closer than most people realize. You could argue that things like Siri and Cortana, you know, these personal digital assistants, exhibit some level of basic artificial intelligence. So it's a really interesting concept. And I think movies like that were somewhat prescient in how they've, you know, portrayed where this stuff is going.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, Dave was giving some examples of modern day artificial intelligence. What are some other things that would qualify as that?
Well, his qualifications were high, right? Some level of consciousness. That's a high and impressive bar. It's amazing how this pervades our life nowadays. We can have a conversation with Siri. It improves month by month. The thing that's actually impressed me the most is pattern recognition. We can now show a piece of software, a picture of students playing Frisbee on a lawn, and it'll say, that is a picture of students playing Frisbee on a lawn. They can classify images, recognize patterns with amazing speed. They can learn from millions of examples very, very fast. I think there's this thrill and excitement is sort of we lose control over our machines. It's exciting and scary at the same time as they start teaching themselves for examples.
Yeah. Wasn't there some research where they taught a computer how to play a video game, an Atari video game, with the object being that just, you know, see how high you can score and see if you can keep improving the score each time?
Yeah, there's been some research with that recently, and they're getting quite good. I think the one game I saw it hasn't beaten so far was Asteroids, which I'm not sure why. I never really liked that game to begin with. I always thought that was kind of lame. But, you know, another good example of this is your average autonomous car. And I guess it's really not that average at this point. But to Kevin's point about pattern recognition, think about all the patterns you have to recognize when you're driving. You know, whether it's the signals and so forth on the road, or signage, or other cars and their behavior. And just think about how complex that is. And I'm not trying to propose necessarily that an autonomous car is an example of artificial intelligence, but it's certainly moving in that direction. You know, it's devices that can, to some extent, make decisions for themselves based on data and hardware power. And as these technologies improve and get faster and the bandwidth increases, it's going to be you're going to get closer and closer to that capability where suddenly the machine can think for itself.
You know, Ann Thompson did an interesting story for Focus on Technology, I believe it was last week, where she talked about the algorithms that they're working on that are rather ethical in nature. It's the ethics of, do I crash into a bicycle or do I crash into an SUV? If I'm the autonomous car, what's the safer outcome there?
Robot ethics, including autonomous car ethics, is actually huge. You have the complications of interpretation. Everything that's hard about interpreting the law becomes more complicated when you're interpreting the context with the real human beings in a real environment and things moving fast. Code is complex. It's hard to tell what a piece of software is going to do anyway. In a theoretical sense, it's technically unpredictable. You can actually prove a theorem about that and combine the complexities of the real world and what's sometimes called the genie effect. You tell the genie you're wishing for something and the genie cleverly misinterprets it. It's exactly what you don't want. So
there's a great Twilight Zone episode with that exact premise.
Which one was that? Which one was that?
It's the one where the old guy owns a pawn shop and he finds a lamp and it's got a genie in it, and everything he wishes for, the genie sort of twists it around. And it's I don't remember the name of the episode, but it's if you want to understand what Kevin's talking about, watch that.
Well, that's one of the things you have to consider with AI, right? You have to be careful what you wish for.
Well, and I guess that's the thing. You know, I think, you know, I'm probably more on the con side of this, and I'm not overly fatalistic. I don't think it's just guaranteed to go bad. But having spent most of my career as a software developer writing code, to Kevin's point, you know, it's almost impossible to consider every variable. And for no other reason, it's just too costly to put in the time, and, you know, unpredictable things happen. That's why I can tell you I won't be riding in any autonomous cars anytime soon. There's just too many variables at work there. But, you know, the idea that this could somehow potentially get out of control, I think is while I'm not losing any sleep over it, and I think it certainly doesn't have to work out that way, this has the potential to go bad.
Kevin, how advanced is the artificial intelligence that we have in place today? I mean, how can you quantify that or put it in perspective?
It's hard to picture how advanced it is. I mean, I tell my students that this is not a new thing. You could say since the 17th century, people have been thinking about how to do this. I mean, one of the inventors of the calculus, Gottfried Leibniz, worked on the problem of how do you represent knowledge in a kind of a programming language, you reason about it. The amazing thing that's happened in, say, the past 30 years has been supplementing our focus on, say, languages from the programming and math side with statistics and lessons from the brain. You'll read about artificial neural networks, which process signals through layers of little systems that work like brain cells that are learning things very fast from examples. I have a team of students right now, and they're using the graphics processing units that typically you'd buy on a gamer's computer to do very fast computations in machine learning. And that really is the state of the art now. And when you see IBM system Watson playing on Jeopardy, it's not just one single program. It's several cooperating programs with different types of intelligence interacting together. That's exciting, and that's the promise.
Yeah, I mean, who would have thought realistically you would see a machine beat someone like Ken Jennings at a game like Jeopardy? It's pretty amazing how fast this stuff has advanced. And I'm sure there's stuff out there that neither one of us know anything about. That's one of the, from the con side of this, one of the things I think if you look at people who spend a lot of time researching this, guys like Nick Bostrom, who wrote the book Superintelligence, fascinating book. You know, his premise is one of the ways this thing could get out of control would be you have sort of an arms race, right? I want to be first. I want to be the guy that did artificial intelligence, really created true artificial intelligence. And, you know, you're working on a team. I'm working on a team. We're competing with each other. What we're doing may not necessarily inform one another. And all of a sudden, this thing happens. It becomes aware to whatever degree. And then, of course, it just kind of takes off on its own at that point. Kind of like the Skynet theory of Terminator, you know.
Which we hope never happens.
Yes.
But the book Superintelligence, that's more of a philosophical look at the issue, isn't it, Dave?
I mean, the guy's a philosopher, but it gets fairly technical. It's a pretty heavy read, but it's just really fascinating because he goes real deep into all the different ways this could potentially work out well or could go bad. So it's a pretty interesting book.
You may have been more persuaded than I was. Now I'm swiping through it on my iPad on the plane yesterday. He's a brilliant philosopher. Before this book, he was known as having us examine the thesis that we're all actually characters in a giant simulation, that we aren't real, that we're in a game played by a superintelligent race. We're all
a la the Matrix.
Sims. So he's actually brilliant. And his book is actually precisely written, but I think we have more to worry about than superintelligence. I think maybe that will happen. I think the big risks are probably before we get to that point. We have nuclear war and terrorism, global epidemics, political, social chaos, and so on. I mean, if we can be stable as a set of societies for long enough to get to the singularity, good for us.
Yeah, and I think there's probably a higher percentage chance we'll get nuked before computers become aware and nuke us. But I wouldn't really disagree with Kevin on that point.
Go ahead, Dave.
Just to think there are a lot of interesting ethical abstract concepts involved here. For example, we kind of touched on this a second ago, this whole idea of, does a machine have consciousness? If it does, what rights does it have? You know, if it's a thinking, I guess, living thing, I don't know if you could qualify it as that. Again, where is the line drawn on these things? So I think there's a lot more to this than just the technological standpoint of it. And one of the things I think is interesting in Bostrom's book is he talks about sort of the ethics of this and the whole idea that if the creators don't set the right final goals for the artificial intelligence, once it becomes aware, you hit this singularity, it could become a singleton where it's like, you know, this tyrannical ruler bent on whatever its goal is. He talks a lot in the book about paperclips. You know, if its goal is to make the most paperclips in the most efficient way, it could literally wipe out everything on the planet in its, you know, sort of obsessive goal to make paper clips. It's really interesting.
Wow.
It's somewhat depressing.
Well, isn't that also where the idea of you get a artificial intelligence that just it recreates itself and it tries to keep bettering itself every time it comes out with a new version?
Yeah, he talks about that a lot in the book too, this idea of a fast takeoff. You know, most experts I've read, and it'll be interesting to see what Kevin's seen and what he thinks about it, predict probably a slow takeoff where it doesn't just suddenly become aware overnight and get out of control, that sort of slow incremental advances eventually work their way out into society and human beings have some time to figure out what does all of this mean and how to deal with it versus what you mentioned, Mark, the idea of a fast takeoff. All of a sudden, the thing becomes self-aware and then can work on improving itself. And suddenly you hit this singularity point where literally it's so far ahead of what human beings can even conceive of. There's no way to combat it if it decides that it wants to wipe you out.
Well, the melodramatic moment in a science fiction movie where there's this long minor chord and someone whispers, just become self-aware. I think it's overestimated. I mean, the danger, I think, is not so much in self-awareness. However, self-replicating robots, this is a thing, right? Yeah. In the 1940s, Johnny von Neumann, famous early computer scientist and mathematician, formalized this theory of self-reproducing automata. I think especially as we move away from traditional notions of silicon-based computer hardware to working into biocomputing, working in proteins and DNA, which is already being done a little bit, integrating that with our computing technologies, perhaps that's scary. So you can easily get technology out of control without it having to become self-aware.
How far off are we from much more advanced forms of artificial intelligence?
Well, I think it depends on who you ask. I did a little research on that before we started today. And there's an organization, they had a symposium in 2012, the 2012 Singularity Summit, and they did a survey there of the folks that attended. And they came up with a median value of 2040 for when you will hit this singularity concept. And that's with about 80%, you know, confidence in that number. So people are still all over the map. You got guys like Ray Kurzweil out there telling you, you know, we're all going to basically be vaporized in 2025 or something like that. Mm. But, you know, I think it depends on who you ask. There are plenty of other experts, if you look at this, who basically say they don't think it'll ever happen. I'm probably less convinced. I think as the technology rapidly advances, it will eventually. I just don't see how it can't happen, barring some sort of other event like Kevin mentioned, like nuclear war, or we get hit by an asteroid or something like that.
We will continue our conversation about artificial intelligence. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Joining us to look at the implications of artificial intelligence are Dean of the Northern Kentucky University College of Informatics, Dr. Kevin Kirby, and Solution Architect and Partner at Definity Partners, Dave Hatter. You can be part of the conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. It's interesting that it seems like lately you've had, as we were talking about earlier, Hawking and Gates and Stewart and Musk all of a sudden taking notice and saying, boy, this could turn out to be a real existential threat. But this idea is actually been around a lot longer than it, hasn't it, Dave?
Yeah, it's nothing new. I mean, this goes back, I think, to the 50s when guys like von Neumann, and I'm sure I'm not pronouncing his name right. And I mean, there's been people who have been doing research into this for a long time, and it seems they have gone through various eras where they make a lot of progress, then it kind of dies out, then they make some progress and it dies out. I think one of the things really driving it down now, though, is the hardware has gotten so much more powerful. The bandwidth is available. You've got big data. You've got all these different concepts that come together that certainly, while I don't think qualify as artificial intelligence in the traditional technical sense, we're getting closer and closer all the time. And I think, you know, people are starting to realize that this singularity concept could happen certainly in the next century or so. And that these are the kinds of people need to start thinking about this and understanding the potential societal consequences. For example, even without artificial intelligence, we're already seeing more and more automation pushing more and more people out of jobs. What's it going to mean for society when even complex jobs like a lawyer, right, where you think how you're going to automate something like that? Well, if you have enough rules and you have enough data, you can probably come up with an attorney that would be just as good as most average attorneys. So as more white-collar workers get replaced, they get supplemented, eventually are knocked out of jobs by technology, you know, it's going to have a pretty significant societal consequence. I don't know what that is and don't claim to have any answers for it, but I do think it's the kind of thing people need to start having conversations about.
Yes, these are the fears, right? I don't think it's the super intelligence apocalypse and singularity that we need to worry about. But yes, the displacements as we rely more and more on a digital economy, as we rely more and more on software. If we have 10 million lines of code in our car and no single human being or small group can actually comprehend what it's up to, code is inherently hackable. It is inherently ignorant of context.
You can make mistakes. You can have bad programming.
Oh, programmers never make mistakes, Mark. Never.
it's actually amazing. You know, it's hard enough to find a bug in 100 lines of code, you know.
It can be very difficult.
Can you imagine in 10 million lines of code? But yet the very nature of code means it's open to clever duct tape solutions and bending it to your will, and It's very interesting. So I think it's bugs, it's hackability, it's all sorts of economic distortions. If we don't think very carefully about the digital world, I mean, as someone who is involved with the teaching of software developers, I think it's huge. You can't have a one-dimensional view of training someone. I'm writing code. I'm just thinking about code. That's my whole world. You have to think about the broader social, political, intellectual context of what you're doing, because it's a huge burden of responsibility to be someone who writes code in the 21st century.
Couldn't agree with you more. I think as more systems become automated, as more devices, you get into things like the Internet of Things, right? More and more devices are picking up data. They're doing stuff with that data. And I totally agree with your point, Kevin, about the hackability of things. I think, unfortunately, you have a lot of developers who do kind of have a single-minded perspective on this. They don't think about the implications. Certainly, security is a huge problem. And I mean, we see all the time systems that were designed without any forethought of security whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And the whole concept of digital disruption, much less artificial intelligence, is going to increasingly impact all of us. And I think to Kevin's point, unfortunately, maybe not enough attention is being paid to it, despite, you know, some Skynet-type artificial intelligence wiping us all out. It may happen because somebody shuts the grid down, you know, long before we get to that point.
And Kevin, isn't there something called the Sorcerer's Apprentice theory, which says that it might not behave exactly the way you think it's going to behave?
Yes, well, I think of Fantasia, right? So in the MOPS. Yes, actually, in Bostrom's book, he uses that as one of the case studies of how something can get out of control by following a literal prescription. Okay, not unlike the genie metaphor. Computer programs start out as notoriously literalistic, and it's hard to communicate intention with them.
Yeah. 513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Let's talk with Charles in Blue Ash. Hi, Charles.
Yes, how are you?
Good, thank you. Go right ahead.
Listen, not being a computer type person, though I know how to turn one on, my interest is more in the fact that you're developing a sort of a construct logical system that's inorganic, means it just makes decisions based on all the possibilities and the most practical. Being controlled by an organic system, which may make decisions, but they're not always the most practical.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
And wondering if the real danger is that it begins to make decisions on the practicality of issues as opposed to the organic system, which has other kinds of things like emotions to deal with, and family structures, which necessarily a computer doesn't have to deal with. Okay. And is that more the threat? Mm-hmm. Is that there'll be a different kind of ethics being developed by a computer versus a human construct?
I think that's a very good point. I mean, we think of our view of computers is they're cognitive, rational entities that are supposed to reach the correct conclusion from a set of premises. But in reality, we don't work that way in the real world. Emotions actually guide our intellect, and that's actually not always a bad thing. It was actually a trend in artificial intelligence research to think about ways where you can guide search and problem solving by having sort of artificial emotions. The big point is that our systems are gradually moving from this artificial digital world to our real world. They're having sensors. They're interacting, moving around in the world, interacting with humans, interacting in physical space. And in some way, they need to adopt some of the same principles that we as organic beings have. And actually, I'm afraid sooner or later they'll actually become organic because we can do that with technology.
Yeah, computer scientist Stuart Russell says artificial intelligence should be provably aligned with human values. Is that what he's
saying? Oh, I couldn't agree more. Yeah,
about?
Taught out of his textbook.
Yeah. Okay, what exactly does that
mean
when he says
right
that?
On target. Well, often in science and in technology, our technologies have their own momentum because they're interesting. But when you deal with danger, we have to bring our full wisdom to bear, and we have to think of these consequences of things. It's very hard to think of anything that's value-free. We're building something, we have to ask, why are we building that? And it's especially critical when you deal with technologies that can get out of control, like some DNA technology in some case, and above all, computer technology.
Grey goo. Yeah, I agree with you, Kevin. I'm not sure all the time that inventors, scientists, et cetera, think about, you know, how could this necessarily go bad? They want to be first or whatever. But yeah, I think that's a key aspect of it, and being able to imbue some kind of ethics into the mix. I don't know exactly how you do that. I think is a key aspect of it, because if you just end up building a machine that's, you know, 1,000,000% faster in thinking than human beings, and it decides that you're just a scourge on planet Earth, I'm not really sure how you're going to take something like that on. So
Dave, what do we do? What do you think needs to be done to keep artificial intelligence from getting out of control someday?
Well, that's a really good question, Mark. I'd like to think that probably the only way you're really going to prevent something like that from happening, assuming that it's possible at all. I mean, there are plenty of experts who, as I mentioned before, said it won't happen. I don't think that's true. I think eventually you'll get to a place where it will happen, at least to some degree. I think ultimately it's going to have to be the people working on it need to realize that there isn't potential existential threat to this thing, and trying to, you know, whether it's Asimov's three rules or, you know, trying to figure out a way that this thing will align its goals with humanity's goals.
And I think the people working on it have to be not just computer scientists. I think they have to be philosophers, anthropologists, historians, political scientists, economists, you name it. You need to bring the full wisdom of the human race to bear on this.
I agree.
Well, thank you for joining me this afternoon. Dean of the Northern Kentucky University College of Informatics, Dr. Kevin Kirby, and solution architect and partner at Definity Partners, Dave Hatter. Next, we'll hear about an incubator for local authors, and in focus on technology, giving voice to people who can't speak. Thanks to Carolyn Groger for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.